Good morning, Portland, Maine. You're listening to Smart Talk with Stephen and News Talk with your little B, 1310 AM. Big show today. Deb, how are we doing?
Good. How are you?
How's your summer going?
Great.
Are you going anywhere or just hanging around?
I am probably going to Bar Harbor because you've been talking about it so much.
Oh, wow. Bar Harbor. Do you know where you're going or staying or just driving
Not
out there?
Yet. No, I'm trying to convince my husband to take some time off. So that's
Harborside Hotel is lovely. Good. Having lunch or dinner at Stewman's. And you have to go up to Jordan's Pond. You have to go up to Cadillac and have some of those, popovers.
Yes.
Yeah, and just walking around there, it's so beautiful up there.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bar Harbor, it takes a little while to get to, which makes the journey, you know, that much more special.
That's right.
But it's such a it's the gem. It's one of the great tourist gems in the whole state.
I agree.
So enjoy that.
How about you? Are you traveling anywhere?
Where am I traveling? San Diego, back and forth. Yeah, you know, about a month ago, I came back from Iceland.
Yeah.
Heading to Wyoming.
Oh, I love Wyoming. I lived in Evanston for a while.
Really? I'm going to Cheyenne.
Nice.
And just booked a trip for 2 months from now to go to Singapore and Hong Kong.
Wow.
We'll talk about that as we get closer. A little foreign trade mission I've got going.
Nice.
You know, it's the opposite side of the world. There's a 12-hour time difference, and it takes like a 22-hour flight.
Wow.
But we'll talk about that soon. Let's get to our interview that we did last week. We had John Hink, who was in the studio. He's Portland City Councilor. He served in the Maine House of Representatives, I believe, for 3 terms. Very involved with Maine politics, as well as environmental issues and energy issues. And here is my interview with John Hink.
Still by the side of the city halls, in 5 minutes of the month in the past, when no one's waiting to find you. People stop and stare at me outside the hall. In other lives we don't succeed, but the rain in Appian Street fills a silence and no words could in the back of your mind. You leave it alone, but after you leave you'll be breathing.
Welcome back. Tonight, Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB. That song is City Hall, picked out specially for our guest today. Please join me in welcoming John Hink. He's a Portland City Councilor, among many other things. Hey, John.
Hello there, Steve.
Have you ever been introduced with the City Hall song before?
I do not think I have.
You may want to request it, City Hall, as the entrance music for whenever you enter the chamber. I know that you guys are big on ceremony. Want to talk about what's going on in Portland as a city. There's a lot of kind of interesting things, and obviously the state legislature has great impact over what happens in all municipalities, but with Portland being the largest kind of metropolitan area, the impact is probably most significant relative to funding and minimum wage issues and everything else. But before we start, you know, you were here a couple of years ago. If we could just cover a little bit, I thought it was fascinating, your background in terms of Greenpeace, your background in terms of not only are you an attorney, but early in your career, you were attorney general for, is it pronounced Palau?
The Republic of Palau.
They're known as the Republic of Palau. And that is a small landmass in the middle of the Pacific Ocean?
Yeah, a fair amount of land, 200 islands.
Right.
And the largest island by size is two-thirds the size of Guam.
Wow.
Guam has 140 or 50,000 people on it. Palau's population is closer to 20,000.
Because here in Portland, you're a vocal advocate for many social and environmental issues, and I think some of that was either informed by or directed by some of your early experiences at Greenpeace in Palau. Can you talk a little bit about early in your career, back when you were just a young idealist like I was? Before you became maybe more of a realist, graduating law school, what brought you to Palau, and then what brought you to the early years of Greenpeace?
Well, it took me till the age of 33 to go to law school, so I had some good years before then. But I sold advertising for a business publication and managed a movie theater. Then I became a buying and booking agent for a movie theater, so... I was just looking to make a living, but answered an ad at one point for a job, and it said sell advertising for a good cause, and that turned out to be Greenpeace. And I sympathized, supported generally what Greenpeace was up to, but didn't at that time think that was necessarily me. It became me in the 6 months that ensued, and I ended up staying there for 10 years.
Wow. And what different roles did you have there at Greenpeace?
Well, between those early years and a return later on, I ran the program for Greenpeace in the United States at one point, and then later was hired to run the program for Greenpeace International for the entire world.
For people that aren't familiar with Greenpeace, it's one of those terms and organizations that is so iconic and embedded in most folks' consciousness. But I don't know if people really understand kind of the root, either the history or the mission or what Greenpeace is doing now, other than kind of good work and frequently involved with environmental issues and issues with the water and the ocean. But what is today's Greenpeace? What is their mission, and how effective are they doing it now?
Well, I must say at this point, I think I'm still a voting member of Greenpeace USA, but I don't really have any direct connection. Occasionally, I get a chance to check in, but I think it's fair to say that Greenpeace is still dedicated to saving the environment and a whole ecology for the entire planet, and takes on the issues that at any given time appear to be of greatest importance. In 1997, when I was international campaign director, I convinced my colleagues that to emphasize a couple of campaigns, we called them, and one of them was to save the remaining ancient forests in the world, including the rainforests and temperate forests, and also tackle climate change.
And that's something that over the years has become progressively a bigger issue. We interviewed a Nobel Peace Prize winner a few months ago, Dr. Lowne, who is known for his work, and he was actually the inventor of the defibrillator, but he was also in the 60s one of the physicians against nuclear proliferation, very active group. And we were talking about nuclear power, and we were talking about what's going on with in that area, and he said, well, you know, forget about nuclear. The biggest threat to the world is climate change. You know, a nuclear bomb goes off, and it would be devastating within a region, but it's not going to completely destroy the planet. But what's happening globally in terms of the ozone, and what's happening with the impact in terms of the Antarctic and acidity levels. I was in Iceland last month, and I went through this area where they're in a glacier. I was with this 60-70-year-old tour guide guy, and he's like, you know, in the last 2 years is the first time in his life he could see an area that was exposed to rock because it was always covered by ice.
And probably had been for hundreds of years.
Thousands. You know, who knows? I can barely spell isotope, but I know it's kind of a big deal when you're doing research in the Antarctica in terms of measurements and carbon and looking back thousands of years and then projecting out millions.
Yeah, people say climate changes, but the scale of change is too sudden now, and we've also never had 7 billion people on the planet when climate starts to shift, and it's going to cause significant problems. We need to address it as rapidly as we can.
Yeah, it's people, it's industrial complex, it's also animals.
Agriculture.
Animals, too,
animals.
Right? Because of my wife's a vegetarian, and every time I have a cheeseburger, it's like, you know, not only shouldn't I eat cheeseburgers, but it's hurting the climate somehow, indirectly with all the gas. We've got John Hink here. He is a Portland City Councilor, also a attorney, former member of Greenpeace, and Attorney General for the Republic of Palau. Let's talk about a couple other timely issues that have come up. Minimum wage. both as a Portland City Councilor and as somebody who lives here in Maine. The Portland City Council recently went through the process of local legislation raising the minimum wage within the city. I think that there's also a referendum issue coming up in November where there's a group that lobbied for and got the signatures to, is it $15 an hour? Is that coming up in November?
That's the proposal.
That's the proposal. So the Portland, what was passed in Portland, and there was some issue having to do with the tip credit, but the Portland increase is it for 10-10?
It would set a minimum wage of 10-10 an hour starting January 1, 2016, and go to 10-68 the following year, and then be indexed for inflation.
What is the status of that? It was passed, and then it had to be rewritten to kind of accommodate the tip workers. And what's the current status?
Well, the current status is it's passed. And there is language regarding the tipped wage credit that I think a majority of city councilors would prefer to change.
And the change being doubling the amount, or was it inadvertently raised and now it has to be kind of amended to reflect the intent?
I think the idea with the majority was to leave that the same. What we should make plain is that tipped workers are guaranteed under the law, in any case, to receive the minimum wage. So tipped workers would have to get at least 10-10 an hour. The tipped wage credit puts a requirement on restaurateurs that they pay tip workers an additional sum of money as a base wage, and then the tips make up the difference to the minimum wage. If they do not reach the minimum wage, then they're supposed to be paid that difference by the restaurant owner.
So if somebody, as an example, is a wait staff at 4th Street, which has a high check average as a restaurant, presumably they would be a highly compensated tip worker. But if somebody was working in some other kind of food service operation where it just didn't have the volume, that the establishment is required to kind of disclose the difference between the tip minimum wage, which is $3 and something, and if the person isn't making on average $7 in tips, then the establishment's responsible for
pays
paying
the difference. Yes, makes it so that they get at least the minimum wage. But you did touch on the issue, and that is that some tip workers in some establishments, certainly 4th Street, we heard from the owner of DeMillo's, would point out that some of their tip workers make well above the minimum wage. They make, DeMillo said, they include the best compensated people in the restaurant, and they do not need to get additional money on top of that. And I would agree that that was not the purpose of raising the minimum wage, was to give more money to the highest paid people in a restaurant.
Interesting. So what would the impact of the November referendum be if that was passed relative to the Portland City minimum wage? Because state legislation would be local municipalities would be subordinate to state law. So if the state passed something saying $15, is that a state referendum or a city referendum coming up in November?
Yeah, a city referendum is on the ballot. Meanwhile, the Maine People's Alliance is gathering signatures for a statewide ballot measure, but that wouldn't make it until 2016.
Got it.
And that would be for $12 an hour minimum wage.
Do you have both a personal opinion and opinion as a Portland City Councilor on what is the best approach to the minimum wage issue? The livable wage, there's a lot of terminology. People look at livable wage as kind of this vague index where people should, if they're working full time, that level of compensation should be able to let people afford basic necessities of housing, food, transportation, healthcare. How should we be looking at minimum wage, do you think?
You know, I tend to find persuasive the arguments that recognize that the free market provides much of what controls in our economy. However, I do think government can adjust the market rules in order to achieve worthy ends. And I've always thought the minimum wage setting a floor was a good idea. If the minimum wage had kept pace with just inflation, it would be much higher than it is today nationally. We've allowed it to lag. So when this initially came up in Portland, my first reaction was the federal government should do it or the state government should do it. It shouldn't fall to the municipalities. I still tend to think that. But after looking at it for a while, I realized, first of all, the federal government isn't doing it. Like so many other things, it is frozen, caught, inactive, not happening. And the state is somewhat similar with our current leadership, particularly in the governor's office, who vetoed a minimum wage increase. I was also thinking that perhaps the economy around the state is significantly different in different places. Maybe it doesn't make sense that we have to wait until a minimum wage is going to be higher in Madrid and Milo, and Portland's economy and the region's economy is a bit different, and we need to show leadership. So I wanted to support a minimum wage that gets us back to having a decent, real minimum wage, which is not really a livable wage, but at least it gives somebody some economic traction who's working full time.
I agree. And the reason why I think 1010 has become this number where things have been pegged to is, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think President Obama set 1010 as a minimum for companies with government contracts. So it was driven, there was a federal standard not applied broadly across the country, but specifically to government contracts. And I've looked at 1010 here in my business as the lowest that we would pay anyone, whether they're an intern or a coordinator or part-time. I believe personally that companies and businesses have an obligation to do what's right regardless of what's just mandated. And as you said, minimum wage has fallen behind over the last three decades. And whether it's compared to inflation or compared to, you know, I'm not a big fan of the whole income equality thing as one segment of the population making more money means that there's some sort of a disadvantage or unfairness to another. But in the case of minimum wage, I believe government has an obligation to step in when natural market forces are being artificially corrupted by companies serving their interests versus the employees.
Well, Steve, what's remarkable is the situation that we have currently where people will be working full-time at major retailers in this country, and their earnings still allow them to qualify for food stamps or other public assistance, which I see as the taxpayers subsidizing those major companies, and it seems dead wrong. A minimum wage should at least put somebody above an area where they would be requiring or needing public assistance. At least that's what we should be trying to do. Right now, I think companies take advantage of the low minimum wage and let the rest of us subsidize their workers.
How do you think that's happened over the last – I mean, I have my own view on big business and what's happened with – my hypothesis is over the last 30 years, I'd like to blame the Koch brothers, and I'd like to blame the titans of business.
The Koch brothers certainly aren't helping no matter what it is. But yes.
In every category. Yeah. If you want to mention coal, you want to mention campaign finance reform. Yeah, they're not helping anything. But I don't blame the businesses as much. I don't blame – I even don't really blame the politicians. I blame we the people. In an elected democracy, I think that if we're not active, if we're not informed, if we're not engaged – then we're at the root issue of when you have a population that's informed, engaged, knowledgeable, they tend to look at the issues, be more aware. They tend to elect people that represent their values. But when people are no longer involved, then that's when, whether it's institutional greed whether it has to do with finance reform, whether it's what's happened in Wall Street 7 years ago.
Well, you know, I certainly agree with you. We need a very active citizenry to make democracy work in this country. But given the circumstance we have where there may not be as much involvement and activism as we might like to see, I also think we shouldn't let those at the top off the hook. I might challenge you a bit on the wealth and income gap. It seems to me that it's perfectly normal for there to be a range of economic success, and that there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. However, we see now the biggest disparity we have seen since just before the Great Depression. And it may just be a coincidence that the Great Depression followed the Gilded Age, when there was an outlandish separation between the wealthiest and the lowest. But we've passed that now.
The Rockefellers, the Hearst, the Castles, all of the opulence of that period, and then it kind of collapsed, right?
And today we've got, we're minting billionaires at a record rate. And apparently they demand it.
I
like the CEO who says, no, I can get by with just a few hundred million a year. Yeah. I could get by with that.
You should applaud that frugality. But I would push back on your pushback, sir,
okay.
Human nature is human nature. So the titans of business probably see themselves as creating great value and worth billions of dollars. But most of that money and most of profits and corporate profits are derivative of a set of policies, how we handle tax policy, how we handle estate taxes, how we handle Wall Street and offshore banking.
Minimum wage is one of them.
Yeah.
But tax policy is a bigger one.
All those levers are controlled by the folks in Washington and the folks at state capitals. And if those people aren't doing their job because they're golfing together or they're friends or they're setting up consulting contracts when their term in office is over.
Or they need enormous private money to get elected.
Yeah. So, but it still gets back to the voters.
It
still gets back to you can't just ask the billionaires, hey, your boat is big enough. You don't need that. You should give some of that back, because it goes against, for many people, sadly, human nature. And that's where organized government, I think, plays a role, is to put the interest of the society and the interest of the many before the few. And if Martha Stewart did more time in federal jail for trading like $30,000 of some stock that she got an insider tip on than any of the banking CEOs or the countrywide people—
stunning.
It's sort of obscene.
Sort of.
Well,
very.
It's very obscene. But in every area, the closer you have between political leaders and lobbyists in healthcare or pharma or FDA or financial reform or tax reform, those relationships become corrupted. Those relationships, the perspective becomes corrupted. And people need to say, I want to elect men and women that serve the interest of the voters. But if the voters themselves aren't saying it, if the voting rates are so low and the knowledge, you know, 90% of people in Maine really don't know the difference between a referendum and a refrigerator.
Well, I bet your listeners are mostly voters. It's how to reach the ones who—
it's a Saturday morning at 11, so they're either shopping at Lowe's or on their way to Home Depot or— but yeah.
But you discuss policy issues, and some people would never turn those on.
Well, we're a nation of laws, right? You're an attorney, and as the former Attorney General of the Republic of Palau, Heavy was the head that wore the crown as the Attorney General of Palau. But all kidding aside, our whole country is predicated on a constitution and basic principles that say— The rights of the people are so sacred, but in a voting democracy, the right to vote, and that's what really bugs me every election. When you look at the number of people voting, which is one metric, but even that isn't a great metric because many of the people voting have no clue about the issues, but it's more of a rote exercise. Like I vote every year or every 4 years I'm going. But we're in wars right now where military men and women, many of them from Maine, are fighting for our democracy and the right to vote, I think, is one of the core principles. And we don't respect it as much as we should. We have 12,000 graduating seniors every year here in Maine, and we don't adequately teach civics. And so there are people who are going through the portal of democracy for the first time they vote, and the voting rates are 3-4% because they're like, well, my parents don't really vote. I don't know what the issues are. I don't know what town government, municipal government, county government. I don't know how the legislature works. And if we don't take democracy ourselves seriously, how do we go around the world preaching the joy of democracy where we've let it languish for three decades? And I think
I think people have to also realize that it's empowering and it's fun to get engaged. And I've been part of an environmental lobby that's part of the environmental movement, and we actually have some traction on that. I don't think overall we're winning, for example, on the issue of global warming, but at least we're in there. There's very little citizen lobby on another very critical set of issues that surround, for example, the tax code. And the number of people that represent ordinary citizens that are in pushing on the tax code is vanishingly small. Meanwhile, every person who wants to grab a piece of the public fisc for themselves, they're dogging the tax code section that affects them, and that's another problem.
And the corporate titans have a whole fleet of lawyers that are sophisticated on tax code. And whether it's the Northern Paper thing with $16 million or whether it's
Kate Street thing.
Yeah, Kate Street thing. So you've got the bright guys who are making the money have all the lawyers, and in Maine,
I bet those titans are divided into two classes. There's the special class that actually wrote the provision of the law that they're taking advantage of. The others are just hiring lawyers to go find the ones that someone else wrote.
Yeah, it said like an attorney. But even the Kate Street thing was just absurd. And I think it was the Labor Committee where some of this legislation had to come through that nobody in the 16 or 14 member in our state legislature, Labor Committee, had any experience in law, finance, or business. And at one point, I believe the committee chairman, I don't recall his name, but I believe he was his day job is at Hannaford, which is a great company, but as a store manager or assistant manager at Hannaford, really not equipped for the complexity of these finance laws, and they just passed something that left Maine exposed.
Steve, you don't shy away from controversy, do you?
Well, you can tell how well that served me in my political career.
I want to name names. I was in that legislature, by the way, and that the bill set the framework, and to have a framework that allows Kate Street to happen was wrong. As it turns out, I voted against the budget, which is how it was actually accomplished. Was in the budget, but that's more or less coincidence because I, not being on the committee, I couldn't have identified this deal in that set of laws that came through. However, we have a member of Congress who told us about his great skills in Wall Street, and he was on the board of FAME. They were the ones that directly approved the specific Kate Street deal. I think it's stunning that more didn't come back to Congressman Bruce Poliquin in terms of that deal.
We have John Hink here, who's a Portland City Councilor, also an attorney, former active member with Greenpeace and involved with many environmental causes. But, you know, relative to the Kate Street thing, I still get back to voters. The story, I think it was Whit Richardson. I forget who did the big,
Whit Richardson.
But it was a very detailed, as they say in the newspaper business, package story because you had to do a lot of investigative looking. It's not like a call.
And kudos to the Portland Press Herald that together.
Yeah, a lot of resources went, but the headline was, was our state legislature not sophisticated enough And I wrote a kind of counterbalance column saying, why would we use the word sophistication? Sophistication, by definition, speaks to, you know, the cultured arts, whether it's ballet or symphony or a person isn't as sophisticated. They weren't bright enough in some cases. They weren't educated enough. They weren't informed enough in these areas. In the same way that if somebody from NASA plucked me out of here today and said, you are now in charge of the Mars Astro Space Program, I would be ill-equipped. I would go, Mars? That's the red planet, right? And if they said, well, you've got to figure out solid propulsion, and we've got, you know, gravity and solar flare, I would be ill-equipped. So I should not run the NASA program.
Well, I have to tell you something else, that most of the time I think the Maine legislature has been a fairly open process and is low in the corruption scale, at least when compared to some other states. However, every once in a while a bill comes up, and the messaging behind that bill is, this is an opportunity to save mills and save jobs, and you will see how much the legislators can get stampeded behind a bill that has that label attached to it. And that was the Kate Street deal.
I know, but that's base impulse. In laws go into 10, 20, 30 pages of technical information. So for our state legislature to kind of listen, to look at the headline, this is going to help. And meanwhile, a couple of financial groups were from Louisiana, I think, that put this package together. They had to be celebrating on like Bourbon Street with giant hurricane drinks.
And they did one day loans.
I know, one day loan. And what many people in Maine don't even understand, because it's, you know, it was a great story and now it's kind of, is that $16 million over the next few years is coming out of the Maine state budget. So it's like a penalty. It's like money that otherwise, $16 million if it went to education, $16 million if it went to summer food programs for kids because we have food insecurity.
I tend to think we should withhold payment on that and with a careful assessment of our legal options, because the deal was scandalous.
It was. But all the bright guys who are the lawyers and the financiers kind of buffaloed our state legislature where – you know, I shouldn't tell this story, Deb, because I've told it before, but our good friend John Hink is here. Last year, I went to the Democratic State Party convention up in Bangor, and I was running for office. But I wasn't really embraced by the state Democratic Party. Something about me speaking my mind and not voting and acting in lockstep with, you know, the party politics. But I still attended to it, and I went to a session, a candidate session, where there were about 50 people, I guess, there, and it was led by House Leader Mark Eaves at the time and Justin Alphont, where the state Senate had the majority, so he was the president of the state Senate. And they were talking to incumbent candidates running for office and new candidates running for state office, and there were about 50 of us in there. And at one point, a woman from a community I won't mention because it'll embarrass her, raised her hand and said, I've got a question. And the question was, I keep getting asked by all these special interest groups to give financial information and my point of view on state budgeting things. And I told you guys when you told me to run, I couldn't do math. How am I going to fill out these forms? And as you know, as a three-time a member of the Maine House of Representatives, and you've been involved with politics and elected an official with Portland City Council. When you run for elected office, many groups want to know what your position is, and many groups want to look at, you know, your understanding of finance and budgets, which is appropriate, right? And the answer from, I don't recall if it was Mark Eaves or Justin Alphont, was, don't worry about it, and I'm using a fictional name, don't worry about it, Nancy. After this meeting, go to Ballroom 4, and a couple of our legislative aides will help you fill out the forms. She's now on two different committees that are overseeing millions of dollars of budgets. And a year ago, she couldn't fill out a single form that had to do with the most fundamental, rudimentary financial information.
That's painful.
It's painful, but it's
true.
We do
have a citizen legislature, so we would grapple with changing that. I mean, I think Mainers take pride on sending ordinary people to the legislature, and they get paid
$12,000
a year.
But nobody sends ordinary people to be president of IDEX or ordinary people to run Procter & Gamble because ordinary people can't do that. And when our country was founded 238 or 240 years ago, and we were in crisis breaking off from England and we wanted to have our independence, the guys who were selected, Madison and Jefferson and all the other, and subsequently other leaders, weren't picked out of the Larry, Curly, and Moe collection. They were selected because they were the best and the brightest. And when our country is under siege or attack or World War II or all these different periods in our history where there was great urgency for leadership, I think voters wake up and go, wait a sec, I don't want an ordinary person now. And after the last 40 years, since we haven't been active, we've had many wars, and sadly, so many people have been injured and lost their life. But I don't think the average American feels the same way as when Vietnam or World War II is happening, where there's, you know, there's a draft or there's urgent crisis. So we don't see the direct consequence.
It's a challenge, Dave. There are states that have professional legislators. They get decent salaries, and they're generally there for many years, no term limits. And I'm not sure they do better. We have people running for president, and one of the best things that they can say to the electorate today is, I have never been to Washington. I am not part of Washington.
Yeah.
I am the furthest thing from Washington. Well, they're kind of bragging about their ignorance of how our government works.
You weren't talking about Sarah Palin there, were you?
No.
There was no subtext.
No, Scott Walker, who's run a state, so I assume he has some skills, although I don't think that state's doing that well, despite what he's saying. The state of Minnesota, the neighboring state, appears to be doing better than Wisconsin. But his major theme is that he's not of Washington.
I know. I should know this answer, and I don't know why. Are you independent Democrat?
I'm a registered Democrat.
Why? Help me with this, because...
Pragmatics, because we have a two-party system, and I would be just as happy if we got rid of that two-party system, and I've done a lot to try and move in that direction, but as long as we have a two-party system, I chose between those two parties the one that's closest to me.
Less evil. Can we mark you down as a reluctant Democrat?
Well... I'm an independent Democrat.
I know, you're an independent, but I hate the party system. I understand the platforms, and I understand having an organizational structure that creates power and force in the political machine. But the Democratic Party and the Republican Party in itself, forget about the ideology and the underlying policies and the craziness about concealed guns and all that, and health care, forget about all that. But the party systems themselves are so depressing.
And it's not working for Americans, and it's definitely not working for Mainers.
It's just insane.
Well, you know, look at all the choices we now have in almost all aspects of our life. And yet in politics, there's a whole alphabet in front of us, and someone says you can choose between A and B.
Or D and R.
No, D and R.
D and R.
But we're going to give you two letters out of the alphabet. Don't look at the rest of the alphabet.
Yeah. You know, here in Maine, I think on the state level, it's about one-third, one-third, and one-third for Democrat, Republican.
Actually, independent's the largest block.
A little bit higher than?
Yeah.
God, I'm a registered Democrat, and I want to be part of the Democratic Party. I believe in the social issues. I believe in caring about people. I believe in health care. I believe in respect and equality. I believe the whole concealed gun, don't believe in climate change thing is just insane. But I hate the organized party stuff where groups of people get together with this kind of this righteous approach of we know who the right candidate is. We know, as opposed to what's best for the people of Maine or what's best for the people of Portland or what's best for Senate District 25. It's not about that. It's the politics of politics that has gotten so depressing that people no longer want to participate.
Yeah, well, most of the time, I'm not sure that the parties in Maine are all powerful anyhow. Very seldom has the party tried to tell me I have to do X, Y, or Z for the party. much less than I think people would assume. Perhaps they wrote me off, but I actually don't think there's that many directives that come out from on high. And it's interesting being in Portland where the Portland Democratic Committee is not really organized much at all. In the largest collection of Democrats in the state, we don't have much of a party machine. Every once in a while, people assume it's there, but it isn't.
Well, maybe it was just me. Deb, was it just me last election?
Oh, it wasn't just you.
I ran for a state Senate seat. And again, I don't want to go into a personal rant here, right? Because our millions of listeners, they don't want to hear that, do they?
Of course they do.
They do want to hear that.
Sure.
Okay. So I ran for the state Senate seat, but the local organized Democratic committee deemed that the person I was running against was the choice.
Yeah, I think every once in a while, for some reason, the forces can coalesce, and they may have in your case.
Yeah.
And perhaps since I only ran for state representative, I'm less likely to encounter it. Those precious Senate seats are bigger, and it was a contested election. I quite closely contested. You might have gotten a lot more attention than other seats get.
Yeah. In my view is, until we get to a point where the average voter, and I'm talking to you, listener, whoever you are right now, you're driving along, it's Saturday, you're being entertained by the wit, the wisdom, the insight of John Hink and Steve-O, please, for the love of everything that's important to all of us, please stay informed. And the issue in government is the same issue in other areas of life, where with things that matter, competency matters. And I've often made this analogous kind of comparison where if Deb fell off her seat right now, Deb, you seem perfectly balanced there.
Yeah, but I might fall.
You may. But if you did, and all of a sudden you broke your leg, right?
Right.
Your immediate response, other than, would be, we've got to get the leg fixed. So would we, A, take you to a local Dunkin' Donuts and try to make you feel better with a jelly
donut?
Might
ease the pain.
Or would you want to go to an institution known for institutional competency like MaineMed, right?
Yeah, MaineMed.
Yeah. Would you like to go in the back of John's Prius, which would be a little cramped, especially with your leg? Or do you think maybe EMT and an ambulance would be a safe?
Yeah, an ambulance.
Yeah, an ambulance. Yeah. Competency and transportation. Mm. And when we get there, would you like to see an OBGYN doctor, or do you think an orthopedic surgeon?
Orthopedic surgeon.
Because
they've got all the right
answers.
They've
got their certificates.
Would you like to have the room next to a president of the United States?
With a neck injury, with Secret Service everywhere. But finally, you would probably want some anesthesia at that point.
Oh, definitely.
And that anesthesiologist, he or she would have gone to school and they would understand the right. They are competent. In every stage of the process, you would default. You wouldn't be, well, I would like to ride in the car that's blue.
Right.
I want to go to the building that seems more comfortable. I want to have the person operating on me who is just as angry as I am.
When my wife was giving birth to our daughter, the anesthesiologist came in, and for the first time, as the contractions have become much more frequent,
right,
handed her 3 or 4 pages of a legal document that she was supposed to understand before signing so that she could receive an epidural.
Oh, that's not
and
fair.
She said at that moment, I'd sign anything. It could have said, you're turning over your firstborn.
Your firstborn is going to Dr. So-and-so. I know, they do that now. Even when you get like, it's getting to the point where you go to the dentist, right? I had a cavity taken care of 2 weeks ago. And they had to redo my patient information. And it used to be, what's your name and address? Do you have an insurance card? They now have like a whole other page of, what's your wife's name? What's her phone number? Where does she work? And it's all about credit information. So if somebody goes belly up or they don't want to pay their bill, they have 9 other places they can bug. It has nothing to do with caring about, I don't know.
I know.
Hey, in the last couple of minutes we have John Hink here. He is Portland City Councilor. Did you just get reelected? Or where are you in the
middle? I've only been elected once there, and I'm in the middle.
You're in the middle. So what's coming up with this whole mayoral thing? Mayor Brennan is indicated he's going for re-election. There's a couple other people that are in the are you in the hunt? Are you have you decided you didn't want to be mayor, or what's the status for the mayor?
I didn't give it too much thought. Sometimes maybe I should be more ambitious, but I thought I have enough to do on city council right now.
And there's a new city council or city manager, right? John Jennings?
Yes.
That's kind of a – feels like there's been a few departures. Yarmouth, which at one point I was the town father of, is the town council chairman.
Lovely.
No longer. I'm backed away from politics a little bit. Apparently, we snagged your planning director in Yarmouth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any other first-round draft picks that we can pick up in Yarmouth? Are there any other city staff? No, I jest. We had, in last week's show, we had a member of the Portland School Board here. And
Holly Seeliger.
Holly. Right. Holly. And we were talking about many things about Portland, and one of the issues came up. She was, I think, active with Occupy. Occupy Maine, Occupy Lincoln Park, Occupy. We just want to use bathrooms here in Portland. Let us stay in our tents. And the issue of Congress Square came up. What was your view on that in terms of, for listeners that may not be aware, this is kind of the cliff notes. Apparently, there was a tiny sliver of city property that the Westin Hotel, which had spent tens of millions renovating the Westland, Eastland, or the East Westland, or whatever that is.
That is a little confusing.
It's a little confusing. It's a little...
The Westin's Eastland.
I know. And then when you combine it with the two words and the sign and the different color, they're... But they wanted to spend about $500,000, pick up that little sliver and do something commercially with it, which many people thought was a pretty good idea. And it was an investment. It would create new tax base and all this. But a group of people said, heck no, this little sliver is critical. We have hundreds of acres of other public space, but this little sliver is precious. What was that all about?
Well, I think it was about it was a third of the space that is currently the Congress Square. And as you described, the hotel would have built an event center. Then Portland would use money obtained in that deal, which many people thought was too little, and redo the entire intersection. I wasn't part of the council when that came up. People asked me during my election what I would have done, and I said I would have liked to have approached it differently than it was approached. But they said, if you had to vote yes or no, I said I probably would have voted yes. So that was an issue in my election, and lo and behold, I was elected. The other guy said he would not have allowed it, and he was not elected, but I think there may have been some other points. The people who have been working on it have helped to make it a more vibrant space, and that's nice. But we still need some real money to fix up the entire intersection and that plaza, that park. And we don't really have that money right now. So it's a little bit in limbo. But I must say that a lot of good activities go on there now. It's doing better than it was. And if we could fix it up, you could imagine we could have a really nice space there.
Finally, with John Hink, what do you see in your role as a Portland City Councilor, the top two or three issues facing the council in a tough economy, in a state that has a weak economic engine, a lot of expense and infrastructure in a city like Portland? It feels like math is the big issue in terms of the cost of running the city versus the revenue that could be generated reasonably from property taxes and local taxes and what's being shared from Augusta. But from your perspective, going forward in the next few years, what are things that the council and citizens should be really engaged on as being critical issues that need to be tackled that really impact the future of Portland?
Well, I hope I don't bore you with the answer. I do think that Portland is a fabulous city and that we've got a very good future, as does the whole region working together, I hope. But it seems to me right now we have challenges on the budget. I'm a little concerned about how high the property tax is. I'm not anti-tax. I'm concerned that it can get too high, and yet we need to make sure the city runs effectively and efficiently, and that's the number one job. Make sure all the functions work well. We pick up the garbage. We plow the streets. We fix the streets. And we make the city more enjoyable for pedestrians and for bikers and other things that will make the downtown even more attractive and enjoyable.
How important is the relationship between Portland and Augusta? When I say Augusta, I mean state government. As the largest city or largest metro area in Maine, and what many people, I think, would agree is the economic driver for much of the state, it feels like it's been dysfunctional for about 5 years.
It feels like there's some hostility from the governor to Portland and perhaps the region. Some of the decisions he's made actually put pressure on our bond rating. If the bond rating took a hit, it would not just hurt Portland. It would hurt the state and him and the governor himself.
Have you spent any time with our governor?
No, very little. I was up there when he was elected and spent a term and had very little interaction with him.
And I've had Mayor Brennan here a few years ago, and I asked him, and I don't know if there's any update from you relative to the city, but I asked him, does he have like a bat phone to Augusta as the mayor? And the time he mentioned that he had never really, other than just at events and ceremonies, he never really had the opportunity to engage the governor on a regular basis.
They've had a meeting or two since, but they're arm's length kind of discussions. I really honestly think the mayor of Portland and the governor of the state of Maine should sit down together no matter how much they disagree on and work things out. For example, on general assistance for asylum seekers or other ways of addressing asylum seekers and other issues they've differed on.
Yeah, I don't get it. Well, really appreciate you being here today. I don't know if we solved any of the world's problems, but it's always interesting talking to you, John Hink.
You mean this week you didn't solve the world's problems?
I'm disappointed. I try. I'm an idealist. I'm an optimist. I think the glass is like 3/4 full. But relative to the political realm, there are so many. I think many of the issues could be solved if just reasonable people sat down. I don't care if they're Republican, Independent, Green, Blue. It just doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
But we have so much static and friction. We have so much anger, contentious, that in that environment, right and wrong, good or bad, climate research, healthcare numbers, helping people, life, none of those things matter when people retreat to positions of, my group says this, your group is this, your guy is evil, your guy is evil, and I hope it changes.
Maine still does some very good things. Our state has sometimes been a real leader, and it still has strength among its citizens.
Well, thank you for serving in the Portland City Council. We're up here in Falmouth, but as Portland goes, so does Southern Maine. So thank you for your contributions as a 3-time member of the Maine House and for what you're doing down in Portland.
Well, I appreciate what you do, Steve, including this show, Just Discussing the Issues.
Just Discussing Issues. That's John Hink, Portland City Councilor, good friend of the show. Wish him the best. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. News Talk, WLOB, 1310 a.m. We'll be back next week.